during the continuation of.
Okay, thank you. So for those who weren't there yesterday, I will recall briefly what the Kronecker solver is. So K is going to be a field of characteristic zero, and the polynomial system that we are interested in is here. So it's a square system with as many variables as equations. And the incremental is done by adding successively the equations. So we need this notation, so this family of ideals for the intermediate systems. And we also use that two other families of ideals. So if for the first family, we complete the system with variables. And as many variables, so that the number of the variables specialized and the number of equations is n, and in the second family we it's the same than GI, but there is one less variable. So we work under assumption that the sequence, the input sequence, is regular, and that these intermediate ideals I are all radical. And in the third talk, I will explain how we can remove these assumptions. But with these assumptions and with generic coordinates, the variety of Ji is zero dimensional, and it's called the highest lifting fiber. And the variety of Ki is one dimensional, and it's called the highest lifting curve. So the Kronecker algorithm looks like that. So after the change of the variable, you start with this elementary lifting curve. And then once you've got a description of Ji, you want to compute a description of Ji plus 1. So this is done within three steps. There's this lifting step, which computes a lifting curve from a lifting fiber. Then you cut the curve with the next hypersurface, you obtain a finite set of points, and then you remove the points that are included in the hypersurface defined by the inequation. And at the end, you change back the variables to obtain the solutions. Okay, so today we are going to make all the mathematics necessary to prove the correctness and to get the complexity bounds for this algorithm. So I'm going to do a real proof from scratch, and we're going to start with primary decomposition and integral ring extensions, and I will explain how the dimension theory and how the degree theory can be done in an incremental way, so that the proofs of the classical theorem are very close to the algorithms. And indeed we will get more than needed, and this to explain that my motivation in this work at the beginning was to extend the algorithm, not to compute what I will explain in the third talk, the equidimensional decomposition, but I would like to extend the algorithm to get the primary decomposition. So I know this is a difficult question, I won't answer that very quickly, but this is my motivation. And there's a partial answer in Diovi's PhD thesis. And the content of this talk it corresponds to that paper. So it's a short paper, 30 pages, and it contains all the mathematical materials necessary to the Kronecker solver. So let's start with the primary decomposition. So an ideal is called primary if whenever you take product of two polynomials, there is either one in the ideal or a power of one in the ideal. And the radical of a primary ideal is a prime, and it's called the prime belonging to the primary ideal. So here is an example with radical, which is just the origin. And this is an example of an ideal which is not primary. You can check it from the definition. So we're going to use this example in several slides. So there's a theorem that you can decompose any ideal in terms of a finite intersection of primary ideal, so which is mainly of topological nature by using the notoriety property of the polynomial ring. So what you do, you decompose your ideal, and an ideal that you cannot decompose anymore, it is primary. So the proof is not very complicated. So for that example, we've got two primary components. Yeah, and I require that the what I call a primary decomposition is sometimes called a reduced primary decomposition. I mean, it's in this intersection I cannot remove any of the QL, so it's kind of minimal decomposition. But this decomposition is not unique. You can see that in this example. So the point on the line can be described by different primary ideals. And so, yeah, there is no uniqueness, but the prime associated to the primary components are unique, and they are called the prime associated to the ideal. And I recall that an ideal, a prime is said to be isolated if it does not contain any other prime, and otherwise it's said embedded. So from a geometrical point of view, this line is, there was a line which was isolated, and the point was on the line, and it was embedded. And now the point is isolated. Okay. Yep. Now, integral dependencies. So A is going to be a subring of the polynomial ring. And it must contain the one. And in almost all the talk, A is going to be of this form, except in one proof at the end. So I recall that elements are called algebraically dependent, modulo I. So this is not very standard terminology, but it's easier in the algorithm description. You avoid to go into the quotient and have class and things like this. So I prefer to use that. Everywhere there is modulo I instead of going into the quotient. So they are algebraically dependent if there is a relation that sends the element into the ideal. Otherwise, we say algebraically independent or free, in short. And so with this example, we've got x1 and x2 that are algebraically independent. So an algebraic element satisfies an algebraic equation. So algebraic over A means that there is an equation with coefficient in A that sends the element into the ideal. And integral is stronger. We require that the leading coefficient of this relation is exactly one. So for instance, with this ideal, X2 is not integral over X1. It's algebraic, but not integral. And it's not a geometrical property. It really depends on the coordinate, because if you replace x2 by x1 plus x2, then x2 becomes integral over x1. And integral element form a subring, so you can do it with a constructive proof by a cascade of resultants. And an even stronger definition is generally integral. So this means that this is integral, but with a property that is very, very important for getting good bounds and even for the Bezout theorem. We require that the degree, which is here some kind of quasi-homogeneous degree, where T as weight the degree of the polynomial E, and we require that this total degree equals this partial degree. So for instance, x2 here is integral, but not generally integral. The degree is in x2 is less than the total degree. But here x2 is generally integral over x1. Okay, so now we can define the dimension by the transcendence degree. So I recall that the transcendence degree of a field F over K is the cardinality of the maximal subset of elements of F that are algebraically independent over K. And the fact is that this definition is well, the transcendence degree is well defined, and any two maximal subsets have the same cardinality. And the main theorem is that if F is given by a set of generators over K, then if you have any subset of gamma which are already algebraically independent, you can complete it into a transcendental basis from the set gamma only. So this is like in linear algebra for completing basis. And this is a very important and the only result to know indeed for that transcendence degree. So from the definition you can get this property. And then the dimension of a prime ideal is the transcendence degree of its quotient field over K. So by convention we let that for non-proper ideals. And if the ideal is non-prime, then we take the maximum of the dimensions of the associated primes. And so from that definition you can get this property. And so from that we can already see that the dimension of a proper polynomial, of the ideal of just one polynomial non-degenerated, is n minus 1. And one more classical definition. So an ideal is said to be unmixed if the dimensions of all the associated primes are equal. So in particular, an unmixed ideal has no embedded prime. Okay. So now let's move to less classical definitions. So first, the Noether position. So the idea of the Noether position is that you decompose the set of variables into two blocks. The first block are variables that are algebraically independent, and the second block are made of variables that are integral over the first block of the variables. And so for instance, X2, this ideal is in Noether position with R equals 1, and this ideal as well is in Noether position with R equals 1. So the Noether position is strongly related to the dimension, and this is the way we're going to compute the dimension in a few slides. And so this is a property essentially coming from the definitions. So if you've got a block of variables integral over the rest of the variables, and you've got an upper bound on the dimension of the ideal, with and this upper bound becomes an equality if the second block of variables are algebraically independent. And on the other hand, if you already have got a first block of variables that are algebraically independent, then you deduce a lower bound on the dimension of the ideal. And the equality holds if the rest of the variables are algebraic over the first variables. And the converse does not hold in general, but it holds if the ideal is unmixed. So, for instance, so with three variables, here we've got an ideal with two components, a plane and a curve. So it has dimension 2. X1 is algebraically independent, and X2 and X3 are algebraic over X1. So in the first part of the definition of the theorem, you cannot put algebraic instead of integral here. This is what this example shows. So integral relation and Noether position play a very deep role in that dimension theory. So as we had integral and general integral element, we now define a general Noether position. So this is the same as the Noether position, except that we require that the integral property is general. So we've got this property of the on the degrees of the integral relations. So for instance, this ideal is not in general position. The degree in X2 is 1, but the total degree is 2. And this ideal is in general Noether position. Okay, so here is an algorithm for computing the dimension based on these constructions. So we enter with an ideal I, and we output the dimension and a change of the variable that put the ideal into general Noether position. So we use the theorem we've just seen. So we start with the change of variable being the identity matrix, and then we are going to check if once the change of the variable is done in I, the variable x1 up to xi are algebraically independent or not. So if they are algebraically dependent, then I can take a relation for them. And if I take the homogeneous component of highest degree of A, and if I take that point on which this component H does not vanish, then I can build a new change of the variable, and then I can decrease I and continue. And when x1 up to xi are algebraically independent, then I get the dimension, and the property is that with that change of variables, I've got the general Noether position. So the induction property. So what we prove by induction is that the second block of variables are generally integral over the first block of the variable at step E of the algorithm. So we've got that bound on the dimension, and the equality holds when the condition of x1 up to xi being algebraically independent is satisfied. And what the change of the variable does exactly is simply summarized in this formula. When you do the change of the variable, you make xi generally integral over x1 up to xi minus 1. And so we take alpha so that this coefficient does not vanish exactly. This is the condition. We take that point alpha so that we get a generally integral relation for xi. So this is the idea of the algorithm. So what we have so far is that Noether position and general Noether position exist, and if you do a random change of the variable, then with a big probability of success, you get a general Noether position. So I would like to illustrate the algorithm with these two equations. So I can replace x2 by x2 plus x3. Then I get a general integral relation for x3. And then I take this this resultant, but I could take any kind of other non-zero polynomial depending on x1 and x2 only. And if I replace x1 by x1 plus x2, then I put x2 into then x2 becomes a general integral over x1, and so that shows that the dimension of this ideal is 1. And we've got the change of the variables with which we have the general Noether position. Okay. So now we are moving progressively to the question of computing the intersection. So we've done more or less with the dimension. And the first property is a characterization of the n-micness in terms of torsion of a certain module. So assume that I is in Noether position, then the quotient ring of I can see as an A module, where A is made is a polynomial ring made of the free variables, and the characterization is this one under the Noether position assumption. This module is torsion free if and only if the ideal is unmixed. Well, the proof is not very difficult. You consider the primary decomposition of I, and the unmixedness is equivalent to the fact that the free variables for I remain free for each component PPL, each reducible component PL. So if B has torsion, then so I can take a torsion element and an element B with that property, and B not being in I, so that so B does not belong to some primary component, which means that A belongs to the radical of that primary component, and that contradicts that equality. So if B has torsion, then I it cannot be unmixed. And conversely, the argument is as easy. So if it's not unmixed, then I have an element in that intersection. And I can construct another element showing that a power of A is a torsion element for B. So this proposition seems rather easy, but it has a very important consequence, as we shall see. So in this example, so we've got, so I don't touch that, we've got a line and the point, and what we see that x1 is a torsion element, so x1 times x2 is in the ideal. So this just shows that the proposition works, and the second example shows that the Noether position is necessary. So this very basic ideal, which is made of two lines, and so it has dimension one, and it is, so it's unmixed, but the variables are not good, and B has torsion. Whoops. Okay, so thanks to this proposition, we can define characteristic and minimal polynomials. And this polynomial, and from that, we'll be able to compute intersections. One advantage of the Noether position is that you can reduce a positive dimensional problem into a zero dimensional problem. So the trick is that with the Noether position, you can put the free variable into the coefficient field. So this is what we're going to do with that A prime and B prime notations. So so with the prime, means that we go into the fraction field of the ring, of the polynomial ring of the free variables, and B prime is the extension of B in A prime, and I prime is the extension of I it's not written, but well, it's a corresponding extension of I. And now we take a new polynomial f, and if I is in Noether position, then B prime is A prime vector space, and it's an algebra, so you can compute the characteristic and the minimal polynomials of the endomorphism of the endomorphism of multiplication by f. And so I write a key for that characteristic polynomial and mu for the minimal polynomial. And so the first property of that so are the following. The characteristic polynomial has by construction coefficients in the fraction field of the free variables. But indeed, the coefficients we are going to show that they are polynomials. So the argument is very easy. We use the Noether position. So f is integral over A, the integral element from a subring. This is the property, and so f is integral. There is an integral relation for f, and the minimal polynomial divides this relation because it's a minimal polynomial. So by the Gauss lemma, we deduce that the minimal polynomial has itself polynomial coefficients. So we've got the first assertion. And in the homogeneous case, we can take the relation to be itself quasi-homogeneous. So we can take that Q, so that Q of TD, where D is the degree of F, is homogeneous. And then the reducible factors of that expression are also homogeneous. And the minimal polynomial is made of a product of irreducible factors of Q. And the characteristic polynomial as well. So we've got the second, so we've got part A. And then if we are not homogeneous, with a general notor position, we get the same kind of property. And so we can take Q such that we have this property, which is the property of f being generally integral over x over the free variables, and there is a classical lemma in polynomial factorization that I'm not going to show, but it's either a consequence of Minkowski sum of Newton polytops, or a classical lemma on Newton polytops. Well, the point is that if you've got that equality, then the same equality holds for each irreducible factor of Q. And then this also holds for any product of these irreducible factors, and so this holds for the minimal and the characteristic polynomials. And indeed, this is the core of the Bézout theorem, as we are going to see in some slides. Then the last assertion is mainly a Kelly-Hamilton, and we use the torsion-free property. So we know that by Kelly-Hamilton over A prime, we know that mu of S is in I prime. And with B being torsion-free, we deduce that mu of F falls in I directly. So there are two elementary examples with that ideal. So this ideal is still the same with the embedded point at the origin, and A prime is just the line. And so the Kelly-Hamilton property does not hold for I. So the Unnickness hypothesis is necessary to get that Kelly-Hamilton theorem. And in the second example, we see that the general notor position assumption is necessary. So if we want to get these bounds, so this kind of bounds, then we need the general notor position. Okay, so the next step now is to see that once you have this characteristic and minimal polynomial, their constant coefficients provide all the information on the intersection itself. Let's start with the first property. I can copy. Okay, so first, by that Kelly-Hamilton property, we already get that the constant coefficient belong to the sum of I plus F. So they actually are related to the intersection. But we've got a stronger property, this one. Which can be proved in four steps. So if you take an element in this intersection that depends only on the free variables, then there's a J like that by definition, and by integrality you can get an integral this integral relation for G, and after multiplying by a suitable power of F, we've got a relation for F, and the minimal polynomial divide or the minimal polynomial of f divides this relation, and then the constant coefficient of this relation is a multiple of mu zero. So we've got this property, this inclusion, and the equality again is due to the fact that the reducible factors of the characteristic polynomials are the same as the minimal polynomial. Then we can characterize two situations. The first situation is the fact that f is a zero divisor can be read off from the constant coefficient, whether it is zero or not. And this already gives us a property on the dimension of the intersection. So this is rather immediate. So if the constant coefficient is zero, then I can show directly that I can show that f is a zero divisor, and conversely, this can be done in this way. So if f is a zero divisor, I can take g like that. And so there exists a primary component of I with that property, and then S falls in the prime associated to Q, and by part A, we've got that mu zero is in that prime, and by Anmickness, we have that mu zero is zero, and then the last assertion characterizes when the intersection is empty. And so again, this can be read off from the constant coefficient. If there are constant but not zero, then the intersection is empty. So we've got already these two characterizations. Okay, so now we have an upper bound on the dimension of the intersection, and we'd like to prove what is usually called the principal ideal theorem. And we can make it with all the ingredients introduced so far. And even you can see the proof is kindly related to the solver itself. I'm not going to do the proof in the general case. So we can discard the non-proper situations. They are easy. Well, we've already seen that in the previous proposition. So we can assume that all the ideals are in general notor position for free. And I will do the proof only in the homogeneous situation. So for the affine case, and then the affine case is a particular, well, is a specialization of the homogeneous case. And by the previous proposition, and the algorithm we saw for computing a general notor position, after a suitable change of the variables, I can assume that the degree of mu zero in XR equals to its total degree. So all of this with generic coordinates, I've got this property. So I've got a ring, an integral ring extension, where the last free variable has been replaced by the equation. So this is really in the spirit of the solver. You change between the last free variable and the equation. So I'm not going to give all the details, but so this is the first step, which can be verified easily, and then we use the torsion freeness characterization. So we want to prove that the radical of the sum is unmixed of the expected dimension. So when I add an equation, the dimension drops by one if the situation is the intersection is not empty. So I use the characterization by the torsion, and then to prove that it has no torsion, I follow all the definition, take the suitable elements, and construct an integral relation for some elements. And at the end, I can prove, because of that relation as polynomial coefficient, I can prove some divisibility property and conclude. So these are all the arguments used in that proof, which is itself a classical proof. And for example, so this is an example to show that the sum, so the radical of the sum is unmixed, but the sum itself is not necessarily unmixed. So this is a classical example of two planes in dimension 4 that I cut with that plane. So I get two lines. So the two lines are the components of the intersection, geometrically speaking. But the two lines intersect, and there's an embedded point at the origin. So the radical is unmixed, but the sum itself is not unmixed. Okay, so now the last proof contains all the algorithm, or it's an algorithm for the intersection, and it's even stronger than the one I need, because it's not only a geometrical algorithm, but it's purely an algebraic algorithm. It's an algebraic algorithm. So we start with an ideal with positive dimension. I suppose it is unmixed and in utter position. And then I take a non-zero divisor. Suppose that you can compute the characteristic polynomial of the multiplication by f, and you get its constant coefficient, key zero. And what says the proposition is that this constant coefficient is already a characteristic polynomial for the intersection. And this is the characteristic polynomial of the last free variable xr. So when constructing an eliminant polynomial, the characteristic polynomial of f, you get as a byproduct directly an eliminant polynomial for the intersection by f. And this is really algebraic. I will explain that in the third talk. But you can obtain the multiplicity of intersection. There are some technicalities. This constant coefficient is indeed in general proportional to the characteristic polynomial of XR. And when we had I, with I in utter position, we put the free variable in the coefficient ring, but after the intersection, there is one free variable left. So we have to consider ideal and rings over that field made of the first R minus one free variables. So the equality between the characteristic polynomial and of XR and the constant coefficient holds if and only if there is an equivalent, the intersection is in utter position itself. Okay, so the proof only uses one very simple argument. We are going to do a linear algebra, but not over a field, but over a principal ring. So the fact that we unspecialize one variable, after specialization, this variable is going to define. Okay, I start the proof with notation. So after unspecializing the last free variable XR, we can extend the original ideal into that ring, and we've got the corresponding quotient ring. And we saw that B, which was the quotient ring of I, was torsion free with respect to the free variables. So now, after putting all the free variables but one in the coefficient field, we've got a torsion free module, but now we are over a principal ring. So So instead of our variables, we've got just one variable, its principal ring, and now we can do linear algebra of our principal ring. And this is the main argument of the proof. So after there is some technicalities. So the first technicality is the Smith form. So the Smith form is an extension of the Gaussian elimination for matrices over principal rings. So that provides you, so the Smith form of the multiplication by F gives you two bases, and the matrix of F in that basis is a diagonal matrix. So the diagonal are made of polynomials in the variable XR, and so the constant coefficient of the characteristic polynomial is the determinant of that matrix. So this is the product of the diagonal element. So what we've got is this formula. The constant coefficient is the product of the invariant given by the Smith form. And A is an element that only depends in the R minus one first three variables. Okay, so what remains to be proved is that the characteristic polynomial of XR is exactly this product. And then we will be done with the first part of the proposition. Okay, so we can exhibit a basis for the co-image of the multiplication by F. So the basis is made of the base of the element given by the Smith form at the target of the multiplication by F and monomials in XR up to the polynomials given by the Smith form, by the diagonal elements of the Smith form. So we've got an explicit basis of the coimage. So you can prove that this is actually a basis, and then in this basis you simply compute the multiplication matrix of XR, and what you see that the multiplication matrix of XR is a block diagonal matrix, and so you can compute that here. So the blocks are made from the companion matrices of the invariant given by the Smith form, and so the determinant of such a companion matrix is the polynomial itself, and so the characteristic polynomial of XR is the product of the invariant given by the Smith form. So we are done with the first part of the proposition here, and well, I'm not going to prove the last part. Okay, so we can see a very elementary example, and the important fact is that you can compute everything here. So once you get the characteristic polynomial, if you are able to compute the characteristic polynomial, then there are algorithms for the Smith form, so you can get the basis. And in this way, you can get a very precise algebraic description of that intersection. So it's not only of geometrical nature, but we really catch what is the intersection from the algebraic point of view. And so that ideal has dimension one, and I compute the intersection with an equation which has a multiplicity itself, and so I've got a very simple basis of the module, and so the Smith form is very obvious. So we've got these two polynomials H1 and H2, and I've got this decomposition of the coimage of the multiplication by F. So as you can see, the computations are not very complicated. An important remark is that this is a decomposition So this is not a decomposition into algebra. So this is decomposition into submodules only. So you don't really get the structure of the multiplicities. Okay. So with that, the Bézout theorem is going to be a simple consequence. Yep. So M is going to be an invertible matrix over K. And the first thing to do is to define the degree. And so the degree is what you obtain after usually the degree is defined geometrically as a number of points. So if you have a curve, you intersect with a curve in a plane. You intersect with a line, and if the intersection is sufficiently generic, then the number of points of intersection is called the degree. And here, by all this construction, we've got a degree that even counts the multiplicities. So the definition is the following. So the degree is the dimension of B prime when I is in general notaire position. And there's a theorem that extends what I just said for that example of curves. This is the maximal number of points that you can obtain if you change the coordinates. So the general notaire position captures the degree of the ideal. So this is the longest technical proof just to make that definition a good definition of the degree. But indeed, this is not needed for the Kronecker solver. To bound the cost of the Kronecker solver, we only need to bound the degree of an intersection, and even if the degree is not very well defined. Okay, so finally, with these definitions, you can easily check this property. So the degree decreases when you take the radical or when you saturate with another polynomial. So here this means that if you remove the multiplicities, the degree decreases, and here if you remove components in your ideal, then the degree decreases. So the Bézout theorem is now a consequence of the previous theorem. So if you take an unmixed ideal, and if you cut by a non-zero divisor, and if you count properly the degree from only the isolated primary components, you have to discard all the embedded components, then the degree of the intersection is less than the degree of I times the degree of F. And there is an equality if this is homogeneous. So the bound follows from the bound we had for the degree of the characteristic polynomials. And so the degree of the intersection is less than the degree of the constant coefficient of the characteristic polynomial of F, which was bounded by that thanks to the general notaire position. So we have done with the essentially with the proof of the Kronecker solver. Okay, so I realize this was a little bit boring in some sense, but I think it's a good opportunity to see that for Grubner bases you can explain what Grubner bases are very quickly, and you can explain what they do, why they solve something. But indeed, once you have done that, well, very quickly, you have explained almost anything on solution set. You don't have the dimensions, things like this. But here, what I wanted to show you is that now we have proofs of the Kronecker solver that are very constructive and well related to the solver. And even these proofs, I will show that in the next talk, allow several extensions of the solver. So I will say, for instance, I will show an example where you can compute the multiplicities of the isolated solutions. So not only the solution, but the algebraic structure of the multiplicities. Okay, so I'm done. Thank you for your attention.